From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
One Paris Night by Carl Edward Wagner. I can't understand how you came to be shot there. Adrian Becker was in a foul mood. He paced about the rubble of the shelled cathedral. In the distance, they could hear the Prussian shells hammering Paris. "What's so odd about being shot in a sporting house?" Sir Stanley examined the dressing. "I meant being shot in the arse." Becker had performed the attendant surgery and applied the dressing himself. While he had some medical education, he had gained extensive practical experience while riding with Quantrill during the recent American Civil War. "I imagine it was the first target the communards saw," Sir Stanley argued. "You saw how they burst in upon us. Paris is in chaos. There is no respect for any institution." "You should have guarded your backside," Becker retained the Prussian zeal for order, despite the fact his former fellow Uhlan Lancers would now shoot him on sight. "Well, it was her backside I had in mind just then, old man," Sir Stanley pointed out. He had found most of a cigar in his coat, and he lit it from their lamp. Despite the risk, Becker had demanded proper light to dress the bullet wound. "Furthermore, one doesn't expect a husband or angry suitor to make an outraged entrance into a whore's bedroom." "Why then did he shoot you?" "He shouted that I had devoured his sister." Sir Stanley sucked on the bedraggled cigar.
"He said what?"
"Well, my French isn't all that good, and he was in a state, but I believe that that was what he said before I shot him dead." Becker observed Sir Stanley with suspicion. "Well, had you?" Sir Stanley was affronted. "Well, certainly not. It's the Parisians who have resorted to cannibalism during the siege, not us. Perhaps I didn't fully understand him. You should understand. One instant, I was furiously at work on Mimi, or whatever her name was. The next, a crazy Frenchman kicks in the door and begins shooting his revolver at me. Yes, and another thing I recall. He called me Bertrand. So then, a quarrel of some sort. The wrong room, the wrong man. Now we are caught between the communards and the Prussians. This is not good." Colonel Adrian Becker, late of the Army of the Confederacy under General Quantrill, had found it expedient to leave the Confederate States of America shortly after the truce was declared in 1868. Born during the tumult of an emerging Germany to a Bavarian countess and a Prussian officer, Becker had returned to his fatherland to join a Prussian Uhlan regiment. His experience had taught him the suicidal futility of cavalry charges against Gatling guns, in this case, mitrailleuses. As the siege of Paris reached its inevitable bloody conclusion this May of 1870, Becker looted the regimental treasury while the rest were looting Paris. In the process, Becker had freed Sir Stanley Sutton, supposedly of the Something Lancers and a British observer. While none of the above credentials could stand the test of evidence, it was proved that Sutton was a spy of some sort, and he was awaiting the firing squad when Becker killed his guards. Becker had known him as British liaison to Quantrill's Army of the West near the close of that war. Becker also knew him as a ready adventurer and an expert killer, and Becker needed help robbing the regimental treasury. A stray shell, French or Prussian, Becker never decided, had blasted their wagon and its concealed treasure. With whatever gold they had earlier pocketed, the two had crept into the wreckage of Paris. In civilian clothes, and with enough gold to buy anything they couldn't steal or bribe anyone they couldn't kill, Becker reckoned they could blend into the chaos of looting and destruction until time to slip away to England. Becker had seen towns sacked from Lawrence to the burning of Washington, and he knew how to blend. Then a crazy Frenchman had shot Sir Stanley in the arse while they were enjoying themselves in a sporting house. Sutton couldn't sit a horse or walk a dozen steps. Becker was a ruthless killer, but he wouldn't leave a comrade. They needed a carriage or wagon, and instead they were hiding out in a shelled-out cathedral in Paris that was in its death throes. Becker wondered which side would try to kill them first. He wasn't even sure how many sides there now were at work at the slaughter. The cathedral was ringed with the bodies of priests and nuns shot down by the communards before the shells had struck. "What's that howling?" Becker peered through the ruins of an 11th-century window. "That's a dog, Adrian." Becker had given Sutton a bottle of brandy he'd found in the rubble. Sutton was killing his pain with liberal swallows. "No, it's a wolf." Becker had lived in the Harz Mountains as a child. Wolf or dog, it's more likely to be the wind. The communards have eaten even the zoo animals. "Have you priced rat meat?" "And I say that it is a wolf. I know that sound." Adrian Becker was in his late 20s, but years of war on two continents had aged him as surely as a saber cut that faintly scarred his left forehead. He was tall, just over 6 feet, and had the broad-shouldered, hard-muscled swagger of a cavalryman. His face was handsome enough to the ladies, although just now his blonde hair and goatee were unkempt. His eyes were of a blue-gray shade, and their full stare was unnerving. He had been trained in martial skills since a child in 1848, after his parents had fled the failed revolution. Sutton had seen Becker draw, but he could never see the movement of his left hand between the instant of deciding to kill and the impact of the bullets. "Why did he call you Bertrand?" Becker had drawn one of his pair of 36 Colt Navy revolvers and was wishing for a Henry rifle. "Who knows? All cats are gray in the dark." Sutton had readjusted his clothing and was feeling quite a bit better, thanks mostly to the brandy. At least he'd had the presence of mind to snatch up his clothing as they fled. While the wound had bled profusely, his trousers, clutched under one arm, had been spared. The cathedral had been close by, and with Becker supporting him, they had reached his cover just as the shelling resumed. Sutton doubted anyone would have pursued them in the ensuing chaos. Sir Stanley Sutton, as he styled himself, was half a foot shorter than Becker and rather leaner. He had a polished military bearing that came of being drummed out of several crack regiments, and an easy aristocratic air that came of being born into a noble house whose name he had agreed never to disgrace by claiming it as his own. He had wavy brown hair, a bristling beard, innocent hazel eyes, and a brooding romantic face that the ladies would swoon for. His skill with pistol and sword had kept him alive thus far in his 20-some years, although luck had helped a great deal, which was why, instead of having faced a firing squad, Sir Stanley Sutton was merely holed up in the rubble of a Paris cathedral with Colonel Adrian Becker, a bullet hole in his bum, shells falling all about, with a certainty that either side would happily shoot down the both of them. Becker fired his pistol twice. Sutton drew his Adams double-action revolver and strained to see what his friend was shooting at, knowing Becker was either dead or dying. "Where are they?" Sutton whispered, seeing nothing. "There was something by the break in the wall there," Becker said. "I could not have missed. The full moon backlighted him." "How many?" "Just the one, I think. He did not fall." "Use my 54 bore," Sutton suggested, holding out his Adams revolver. "More stopping power." "Same bullet as the American 44 caliber," Becker said. "I think the 36 ball is more accurate." "All right then, Adrian. Where's your communard?" "I'll just go finish him." Becker stepped carefully over the rubble, pistol cocked and leaving Sutton a line of fire. There had been something wrong with that silhouette. The man had crouched like an ape, then had sprung away when shot, as though he weren't hit. Becker was certain of his aim. A shell screamed through the night. Becker flung himself headlong beneath a pew. The cathedral's foundation shook, hunks of debris pelted through the breached wall, dust and slabs of plaster scattered across the pew. Almost deafened by the near hit, Becker barely heard the scream of the next shell in time to burrow deeper beneath the pew. This shell struck cleanly through the Norman Gothic arches and exploded somewhere about the altar. Large things fell upon Becker's scant shelter. One of them wore many petticoats and smelled of gardenia perfume. Becker wiped away dust and petticoats from his face, still holding his pistol, which he had managed not to fire. The next shell struck some distance away. Stunned by the concussions, Becker became vaguely aware that he was being held by an equally dazed woman who had parted from her outer dress at some point. She was a lovely mass of lace and stockings and corset, and she was clinging to him fiercely. For an instant, Becker wondered whether she might be an angel dragging him to heaven. However, this seemed an unlikely destination for him, and no angel would wear a whore's perfume. Besides, he recognized the face beneath the grit and tousled black hair. Jacqueline? Oh, Adrian, she clung to him with far more ardor than she had shown him earlier that night. It is horrible out there. I followed you when you two fled. There was much blood. Becker lowered the hammer on his Colt. He struggled upward, dragging both of them to their feet. His ears rang and his head throbbed. From the shutters beneath his feet, he sensed that the shelling was moving away, for now. You should have taken refuge in the cellars, Becker was trying to ascertain Sir Stanley's earthly presence. The lantern had somehow remained intact and alight. Something was stirring amidst the debris. Bertrand was hiding there, Jacqueline hissed. Lucky for him, Becker said. He led Jacqueline over to where Sutton was cursing, and he pulled away some wainscoting that had probably been in place for 5 centuries until a minute ago. The Englishman was unhappy, but unhurt. He thanked Becker with a scant courtesy, then favored Jacqueline with a begrimed smile. Jacqueline pressed back against Becker. It is not Bertrand, but with his beard, he looks like Bertrand. Sehr gut, said Becker, still stunned and struggling with his English. At least we have one thing here tonight settled. This Bertrand. Who is he that someone shoots my friend by mistake? Jacqueline's eyes widened. Bertrand is a loup-garou. I believe she means werewolf, Sir Stanley supplied. Is there any of that brandy left? Becker asked. Sir Stanley surrendered the bottle. This is a lot of rot. Becker took a swallow, handed the bottle to Jacqueline. I told you I heard a wolf. I was a child in the Hartz Mountains. I do not miss when I shoot a man. Jacqueline coughed a bit after her liberal swallow. Sir Stanley gallantly arose and presented her with his coat. Becker was mumbling to himself in German, watching the openings in the walls. Finally said, Yes, I know what a werewolf is. Come on, old man, Sutton suspected shell shock. This is the 19th century, after all. Adrian is correct, Jacqueline interceded. I have seen this thing. He killed Yvonne, bit her through the throat, chewed her flesh horribly. He was Bertrand when he entered her room, but when we broke down the door, it was a wolf that leapt from her window. A wolf escaped from the zoo, Sir Stanley explained. It was famished and lucky not to have been eaten itself by the communards. He put his arm around Jacqueline purely to reassure her. How did you find this? Becker asked suddenly. He was recovering from the shell blast. I saw which direction you had fled. Then I followed the trail of blood. The moon is quite bright. From outside the cathedral echoed a long bestial howl. A shell hit in the near distance, muffling the cry. Becker searched his pockets. Who has silver? He found a few gold coins and some copper. Afraid I'd paid Mimi in advance, Sutton apologized. Jacqueline had obviously fled in haste. A cross? Becker asked her. Some rings. But she only shook her head and pressed closer to Sir Stanley. We must have silver to kill the werewolf. Becker looked all about. Perhaps a crucifix from the altar. You won't find as much as a biscuit, Sutton said. This cathedral was thoroughly looted while the communards were at work, butchering everyone from Mother Superior to altar boy. Becker peered through the broken wall carefully. Well, we'll have to look for silver. I can't say how long Bertrand will be content with the nun. What? Sir Stanley joined him at the breach. The full moon glared down upon the churchyard beyond. Tombstones and funeral monuments shone white and shattered like a scatter of broken teeth. The corpses of the executed clergy lay in rows. Something was moving upon the body of one nun. Sutton's first thought was of a man in a fur coat. Then he saw that, while it was male, it wasn't a man. It was a man-shaped creature covered in dark fur. Its face was the muzzle of a beast. The nun's habit had been ripped apart, her legs outflung. As the creature hunched obscenely between her thighs, its wolfish muzzle gnawed at her dead breasts. Sutton turned away, stunned for once in his checkered career.
"It is Bertrand," Jacqueline said.
"Don't look," Sir Stanley pulled her away. "She is a whore in a city gone mad," said Becker. "What now can shock her? But why has nothing been done to destroy this Bertrand?"
"We only recently suspected Jacqueline was in a near faint. With all this killing, the riots, how are we to hide his crimes amongst so many?"
"Shoot the thing, man," Sutton relinquished the collapsing girl, and drew his revolver. "It will only return his attention to us," Becker pushed away the other man's gun. "We must have silver."
"And if we can't find silver?"
"Then we must hope that he will be content amidst the dead until daylight. Unfortunately, the werewolf prefers the blood and flesh of the living, and you, my friend, have left a recent blood trail. I think that very soon he will come for us, and you are unable to run."
"Then I say, give him a bellyful of lead, right now."
"Sir Stanley, I tell you that I shot him. As you can see, there was no effect. Watch him now while I search for silver."
"And what if he moves towards us?"
"Then you must shoot him and pray that I am wrong."
"What about fire?" Sutton wondered, watching the necrophilic feast with growing horror.
"Well, first you catch and skin him," Becker suggested. "I'll get a fire started to roast him over."
"Firebrands," Jacqueline said. "Wild beasts fear fire."
"Werewolves are only part beast." Becker picked up the lamp, "and they move very fast."
Jacqueline gathered up her petticoats to follow him across the rubble. "You seem to be very well informed of the loup garou. Have you bagged very many?"
"One is sufficient," said Becker, and she thought she saw him shiver. It was probably only the difficulty of walking over the rubble-strewn floor as they approached the ruined altar. Becker held high the lamp. "Look for a crucifix, a chalice, silver plate, anything the looters missed." The shell had blasted the altar into hopeless debris, piercing the cathedral floor and disgorging the crypts beneath. The bones of crusaders and bishops were heaped together in shattered and moldering piles like the wreckage of unstrung and rotted puppets. Broken swords and rusted armor lay amidst desiccated flesh and tatters of worm-eaten finery. The smell was of dust and mold, the stench barely noticeable against the greater stench of smoke, burnt powder, and recent death that pervaded Paris this night.
"I can't bear this," Jacqueline shuddered and covered her face with her hands.
"Then hold this lamp," Becker thrust the lantern toward her, waited until she had it in her grasp, then carefully clambered down through the rubble into the exposed crypt. He had seen far worse too many times before, and the moldering skeletal remains of the centuries dead held neither terror nor awe so long as they didn't move.
"Here, shine the light here, Jacqueline."
The wreckage from the shelling made it impossible to be certain of anything. Everywhere bones and fragments of rusted armor and rotted vestments. But Becker judged the crypts dated from the Crusades. There was a black chalice lying intact amidst the rubble, evidently dislodged from the crypt by the explosion. Becker recognized age-blackened silver, and he snatched it from the debris. A skeletal hand clutched at its stem, refusing to relinquish its grasp. Becker swore as a chalice was pulled away from his fist. Drawing his bowie knife, he hacked frenziedly at the leathery knots of desiccated flesh and bone, prying the dead fingers one by one from their grip. Steel prevailed, and in a moment he was scrambling out of the crypt, carrying his prize.
"Now we must have a fire. Gather some of this wood, please. We must hurry, Jacqueline."
"The beast has moved away into the shadow," Sir Stanley warned, as Becker busied himself with his kit. "I can't spot him."
"Keep looking."
For his pistols, Becker carried percussion caps, a flask of black powder, a tin of grease, waddling spare balls, a capping tool, and a bullet mold. While Jacqueline made a fire from the smashed woodwork,
Becker quickly removed powder and ball from the cylinder of one Colt Navy revolver. With his Bowie knife, he hacked the ancient silver chalice into chunks. Becker was pleased to see that it was indeed of silver, a plain chalice, obviously quite old. Becker had no time to appreciate its antiquity. By the time the fire was going well, he had recovered a rusted scrap of a crusader's helmet from the crypt, sound enough to serve as a melting pot. Becker dropped in the mutilated chalice and waited for the silver to melt. A wolf's howl reminded him of the need of urgency. "Can you see him?" Becker fanned the coals. "The clouds are across the moon," Sutton told him. "I can't see anything." "Jacqueline," Becker pointed to some smashed paneling. "Make firebrands."
"But can't these kill the beast?"
"They might discourage him from further courses of his dinner." Becker blew on the coals. Silver melted at almost 3 times the melting point of lead, but the fragments of the chalice were at last beginning to slump and mingle together. Looking about, he found sections of a medieval tapestry crushed beneath the rubble. Quickly, he hacked away pieces with his knife to make padding for his hands. Positioning his bullet mold, Becker clumsily gripped the glowing fragments of helmet, removed it from the fire, and poured, trying not to spill much of the molten silver. Replacing the makeshift pot, he flicked the spilled pools of silver back into it, waiting for the mold to cool. Any sign of the beast, Becker opened the mold. 3 glinting balls of silver shook out. "The moon is clear, but I can see nothing," Sutton called back.
"Perhaps Bertrand has eaten his fill," Jacqueline said.
"While the moon is full, nothing can sate his bloodlust," Becker poured again into the mold, then trimmed the flashing from the 3.36 caliber bullets, cursing as the hot metal burnt his fingers. They must cool a bit more, or he'd risk their igniting the powder as he charged his pistol. Becker poured a little of the brandy over the hot balls. He opened the bullet mold and cracked loose another 3 bullets. There remained a good quantity of silver, but time was the essential matter now. Becker now had 6 silver bullets. He decided to risk the first 3 and began to load his revolver, hoping that the wadding would protect the black powder from the hot metal. The werewolf's growl was like that a mastiff might roar out if he were the size of a bull. Sir Stanley yelled out and fired point blank as the beast suddenly burst through a shattered window. The remnants of medieval glass tore at its hairy flesh, inflicting as little harm as did Sir Stanley's bullets. It reared there for a moment amidst the debris, snarling at them, its wolfish muzzle showing carrion-smeared fangs. It was like a great hairy ape with a wolf's head, and yet there was a red glow of depraved humanity in its eyes. It regarded its 3 victims, taking in their positions as a diner selects a slice of meat from a buffet, then rushed for Sir Stanley. The heavy .44 caliber slug from Sutton's Adams revolver staggered the creature momentarily, but they had no further effect. Unable to run, Sutton swore and flung the useless weapon at the charging beast. Jacqueline ran toward him with a pair of firebrands. Becker charged the chambers with powder and rammed home the silver bullets. He had learned well to reload quickly while riding with Quantrill, and the percussion caps were already in place on the revolver cylinder. Jacqueline threw herself between the werewolf and Sir Stanley, thrusting the blazing firebrands into its face. Roaring more in rage than fear, the werewolf reeled back for an instant, striking away the firebrands with one taloned paw. Jacqueline spun away, just avoiding its claws. Sutton shoved her clear. The werewolf reached out for him. "Bertrand!" Becker shouted. As the creature turned at his shout, Adrian Becker shot him 3 times through the heart. There had not been time to load the other chambers. It wasn't necessary. Putrid smoke boiled forth from the werewolf's chest as the silver bullets tore into him. Flame gushed from the wound, suddenly setting his entire mass of flesh on fire. Bertrand howled hideously, his bestial roar rising into a human scream. Staggering backward, the creature lurched across the ruined cathedral, crimson flames eating through its flesh. Blackened bones were already poking forth from charred skin as it pitched backward like an obscene sacrifice into the crypt. Becker and the others gazed down upon the creature. In a short time, there was little more than ashes. "I told you he must have silver," Becker said. By daylight, the shelling had stopped and most of the fighting had moved to another quarter of Paris. Sir Stanley was still weak from loss of blood, but he insisted that he could walk with assistance. Becker thought they had best press on before either the French or the Prussians restored order here. As they passed through the churchyard, they met an aged priest. The tears on his face testified to his feelings upon viewing this scene of massacre and ruin. Nonetheless, he greeted them, then gazed curiously at Jacqueline's petticoats exposed beneath Sutton's coat. Sir Stanley noticed his look. Always the gentleman. "She was attacked by the Communards, Father. We were able to drive them away in time to spare her, and sought refuge here. As for me, my wound is nothing. Bless you, my children. Such bravery is rare in these terrible days." The old priest gestured towards the massacred victim, then wiped away tears. "God has gathered these in. Stones may be restored, but here in the crypts of this ancient cathedral is said to be hidden the Holy Grail, the very cup from which our Lord drank before his betrayal. A silver chalice, won by the blood of the Crusaders and kept here in secret throughout the centuries." His age-worn face implored them. "Will you not help me search this ruin for it? Those who guarded its secret are all slain. Perhaps its power could bring an end to all this senseless slaughter." Adrian Becker exchanged glances with Sir Stanley Sutton. "Yes," said Becker. "To some of it, certainly." Soul of the Wolf by Brian Mooney. Prelude Trophies. There was an abundance of trophies, heads with frozen eyes which stared down upon Nugent as he sat at his desk in the weapons room. Almost every game animal in the world was represented there. Some had been obtained expensively, under license. Most had been killed illicitly and even more expensively. Many of the animals were drawing near to extinction, but Nugent cared not a jot. He would begin to worry when there was nothing left to hunt. On this evening, Nugent was smugly content. Sipping from his crystal glass of very old malt whiskey, savoring the liquor's smokiness on his tongue, he reached out his other hand to touch, caress even, the laminated card which lay exactly in the center of the desk's exquisite antique leather surface. That card, a license to kill yet another animal of a rapidly dwindling species, had taken him many years to obtain, years of sucking up to sleazy politicians and their fixers, years of bribery and blackmail and corruption. Taking his whiskey, Nugent arose and began to stroll around the huge room, looking at the trophies gracing the paneled walls, admiring his extensive collection of weapons in their display cases. Here an ancient Malay kris, there an early AK-47, next to it a stone axe head. Doc Holliday's greener shotgun used to cut down Frank McLaurie at the OK Corral, nestled side by side with a rusted Saxon short sword. Nugent smiled at one favorite, a well-honed ivory-handled open razor, reputedly owned by an early 20th century gang leader in the Scottish city of Glasgow. There was a time when he had taken that razor and, well, never mind, that was history. A smile flitted across Nugent's hard face as he reminisced. And there, on a small side table, was the leather case which contained his latest hunting rifle, the one which he would use for this new kill. Nugent ran a fingertip along the hard, polished surface of the case and felt a small thrill in his breast. "Christ, damn the greens," he thought. "Bastards just about had the world sewed up these days. But not completely, as that license showed. What harm was he doing?" He was genuinely puzzled. Animals have killed each other since time began. Hell, a man had all the money in the world and more. He should be able to do what he wanted, right? There were times Nugent wondered what it would be like to hunt men. He would love to take a party of those namby-pamby bastards out into the wild and show them how much better life would be when the adrenaline flowed and you knew that each minute might be your last. The hunt. Oh, the hunt. Item: Wolf Hunt. The huge timber wolf was majestic, still and quiet against the gloaming, as if it was a sculpted part of the slab-like boulder on which it stood. The animal's head tilted back slightly, as it delicately sniffed the evening air, redolent with the scent of the ubiquitous pine forest. The great body sloped down from the shoulders to where the bushy tail rested between muscular hind legs. Nugent's slightly adjusted the telescopic sight and the image of the beast became sharper. Although almost choking with excitement, Nugent compelled himself to the state of relaxation necessary for a perfect shot. The Remington's weight was comforting, the walnut stock cool and silky against his cheek, its touch as sensuous as a woman's fingertips sliding gently on bare skin. Behind and to the right of where the wolf stood, the sun was sliding into daily oblivion. Soon, probably, white damp mist would creep down through the forest, impenetrable and seemingly alive, to fill the valley far below. But for the moment, the air remained clear and sharp enough to sting the cheeks and ears. The man's thumb reached out to ease the safety catch forward, and his breathing shallowed. His nostrils wrinkled as he caught an acrid whiff of body odor from the Chinook lying beside him. Nugent could feel the Indian's humid warmth, had an instinct to flinch away. Christ, someone should drag these goddamn primitives into the 21st century. Nugent swallowed his distaste. If it wasn't for the Indians, it was unlikely that he would have gotten anywhere near the wolf, and this trophy had become a near obsession with him. The crosshairs of the scope centered on a spot just below the wolf's ear, and Nugent's fingers took first pressure on the trigger. A final slow exhalation and then the second pressure. There was no recoil as a killing missile, a tiny hypodermic filled with a destructive potpourri of toxins, sped from the rifle's muzzle. The wolf just crumpled as if sinew and bone had dissolved. Nugent breathed in and then exhaled again, a fierce, triumphant grunt. At last, at last. The coveted wolf, and with neither mark nor injury on the handsome carcass. And then Nugent let out an angry yell. What the hell's Two Trees doing? The second Chinook, the younger one who had been so self-effacing, so quiet in the background, was now running at full tilt toward the fallen animal, a long-bladed hunting knife in one hand. As he ran, moccasin feet kicking up dirt and pine needles, the Indian cried out, a weird morning undulation. Nugent scrambled to his feet to give chase, but already the older Indian, Jackson, was ahead of him. What's he doing? Cried Nugent again. Stop the bastard! When the wheezing Nugent reached the Indian, the senior was restraining his companion. The two were having a frenzied argument in their own tongue. All right, what is it? Gasped Nugent. Jackson looked embarrassed. Two Trees wants to cut the wolf's throat, boss. Is he crazy? Nugent spat to clear his mouth and wiped sweat from his face. What does he want to do that for? He turned a snarling face to the young man. Well, why? A sullen Two Trees muttered briefly in his own language. Jackson shrugged. It's an old superstition, boss. Common to a lot of tribes. It's to release the wolf's soul. You've got to understand, our people revere the wolf. Look on it as a brother hunter. It's okay to kill the wolf, but you must honor it as a warrior. You cut the throat straight away. It releases the soul for the hunt in the other world. Don't release the soul in time. The wolf will take revenge somehow. No way, Nugent prodded Two Trees in the chest. No goddamn way. I paid 100,000 credits for the hunt license, and I paid another 30,000 for this specially adapted Remington so that I wouldn't make a mess of the skin. You are not going to cut its throat, Sonny. Not for some damn crazy superstition. Two Trees expostulated angrily with the elder Chinook. Jackson grimaced. He says it's almost too late now, boss. Let him do it immediately. Things might be okay. Nugent hefted the Remington slightly. Tell this damn savage that if he goes anywhere near the wolf, I'll shoot him. Mouth twisted in disgust, young Chinook thrust his knife back into its sheath. As he turned away, said in English, your responsibility, Mr. Nugent. This damn savage tried to do what was right. I just hope you can live with what you've done. The mountains and the forest were dappled silver and black as full moon and smoky darkness vied for supremacy. A young Indian stood on a vast platform of rock which dominated a timber-free clearing, naked and unadorned, save for strange splashes of paint which gave an animal-like appearance to his stringy body. Around the rock, still and uncanny, in their watchfulness sat the gray shadows of the wolf pack. The Indian drew breath and began a low, keening wolf howl, gradually lifting and throwing back his head until, as his howl reached its crescendo, he was staring straight into the face of the moon. The circling wolves, too, threw back their elongated heads as they joined the dirge. Item ceremony. In a small cave amid the towering mountains, 5 Indians gathered in conclave around a smoky fire. 2 were dressed in denims and mackinaws, were shod in stout climbing boots. 1, the elder, was ill at ease, the other inflexible and determined. The remaining Indians were old men, leathery bodies, naked save for necklaces of bone and teeth. 1 of them clutched a small drum, as yet silent, between his knees. In accordance with the old ways, a pipe was being passed around the men from hand to hand, lip to lip, a pipe which contained something more than tobacco, something which dilated eyes and lightened heads and limbs. When all had drawn upon the pipe several times, it was laid to the ground with reverence by the most wrinkled of the 3 naked men. He turned to the disquieted man, deferring to him as a senior visitor. "This white man, this Nugent, you say he offended against the laws of the hunt?" Jackson looked embarrassed. "I didn't say anything like that. The guy was just ignorant of our ways. He didn't mean no harm." "Listen to yourself," Jackson snarled. "Two Trees, you might as well be a goddamn white eyes, the way you try to make excuses for the bastards." "Listen, old father," turning to Jackson's questioner, "I told this Nugent of the law of our ways. He sneered, called us savages, threatened to kill me if I did what was right. So Brother Wolf's soul has no resting place. It cries out for vengeance. Hear me. That night I went back into the forest to mourn, and the Grey Brothers, they all came to where I was. They offered me no harm. Instead, they wept with me. Help, Brother Wolf's soul, old father, help it." The old men drew closer together, muttered to each other in a tongue so old and strange that neither of the guides could understand it. Finally, hatchet faces grim in the orange and yellow flicker of the firelight, they nodded. The one with the drum began to tap a rhythm, a steady thumping beat that inexorably enveloped the senses until it threatened to dominate the mind. The second old man took handfuls of the tobacco and drug mixture, casting them into the fire, which flared and emitted thickened skeins of acrid-smelling fumes. Within several inhalations, Jackson and Two Trees could feel themselves expanding, minds and bodies drifting like leaves on a fickle breeze. Old Father began to chant a strange, low song which, despite its softness, was soon vying with the power of the drum beat. Like primitive paintings daubed onto the cave walls, shadows cast by the old men writhed and stretched and lengthened into monstrous shapes of an almost tangible blackness. Then Two Trees nudged his companion and pointed with slightly trembling finger toward the fire. Awed, the 2 men watched the smoke twirling and dancing as it formed the unmistakable image of Brother Wolf. In a luxurious apartment amid the towering blocks of the city, a sleeping man twitched and fidgeted. For a moment, despite the efficiency of the air conditioning, there was the slightest suggestion of acridity in the bedroom's atmosphere, and the man's nostrils twitched in irritation, as if someone nearby was smoking a mixture of tobacco and narcotics. With a huge spotted handkerchief, he polished the old-fashioned eyeglasses he affected. "We're a dying breed, we hunters, Plum Tree," grunted Nugent. "There's no appreciation for the stock and the kill these days." The taxidermist raised an ironic eyebrow. "You're right there, sir, unless you're some low-life predator stalking and killing men on the streets. Then who cares what you do?" Nugent nodded. "Yeah, running a pack with switchblades or Saturday night specials, and you can rape and maim and kill as many of your own kind as you want. Nobody gives a good goddamn. The cops don't often bust a gut, and if they do, the courts just give the bad guys a slap on the wrist. But you want to kill a wild animal? Hell, you're worse than Jack the Ripper." "You know, Plumtree, there are nights when I walk the streets, the really bad streets, just hoping that some of these punks will try me. I want to see how they'd be when they meet a real predator. But nothing ever happens. Know what I mean? Plumtree put his eyeglasses on, appraised the big chunky man before him. He had heard of Nugent's skill at martial arts, of the wealthy socialite's collection of exotic weapons, of his sheer enjoyment of violence. You don't look like a victim, I guess, Mr. Nugent. He nodded. Now as to the wolf, how would you like me to deal with him? Nugent stood, hand stroking chin, considering the question. I wondered, do you think perhaps mounted standing, threatening maybe, with a snarl? Wallace Plumtree shook his head a little. So very passé, don't you think, Mr. Nugent? And dare I say, a mockum vulgar? All very well for a schoolchild visiting a museum, but not for a person of taste. Why, it would be an insult to the nature of this lovely beast. If I may suggest, Nugent motioned the other man to continue. Well, sir, I recommend flaying. Save for the head, which would be treated and remain intact, then the fur prepared so that the body with legs and tail are supple and soft, able to spread out. The whole would then make a beautiful rug or wall display. I don't want the fur damaged in any way, warned Nugent. Of course not, Mr. Nugent. As you know, I use the very latest techniques, including laser technology. I guarantee that despite the opening out, no harm will come to the fur itself. The night janitor was young and a 1960s freak. That night he was stoned, as he so often was, flying high, away in his own previous century world. He cleaned Wallace Plumtree's outer office, but when he tried the inner door to the workshop, he found it to be locked. This wasn't unusual. It generally meant the old dude had something special in there. Hey, man, imagine stuffing dead animals for a living. Guess it paid well, though. That Plumtree cat didn't look like he'd worried about his next meal for decades. And the rents in this block didn't come cheap. Just as the janitor was about to turn away from the door, he thought that he heard something. It was low and distant and sounded a bit like an animal of some kind. Dog, maybe? Alternately whimpering and howling. Might even have heard the sound of scrabbling, like clawed feet trying to gain better purchase on a polished stone floor. Not possible. All those creatures in there, they were dead, man. The janitor pulled out the remains of the toke he'd been smoking earlier and studied it. Hey, powerful shit, man. Interlude, dream place. Nugent was back at that place of death in the mountains. He sprawled there with the ground hard beneath him and the Remington aimed steadily at the timber wolf, waiting in his arms. The sun must have been setting, for the sky behind the animal was the bright scarlet of freshly spilled arterial blood. Nugent was aware that two Indians stood behind him, although neither one came into his line of sight. He could hear, or perhaps feel, a throbbing as of drums or rushing life-filling veins and arteries. He thought that he could smell wood smoke and tobacco, and beneath that something else, something narcotic. Nugent knew that Two Trees was trying to tell him something, but he could never quite catch the Indian's words. He understood the gist to be something concerning the wolf soul, but he knew too that such a concept was ridiculous. He closed his mind to those unheard entreaties and concentrated on making his shot good. He took first pressure. The telescopic sight was better, clearer than he had ever known it. It focused in upon the wolf's head, and each hair in the coarse fur stood out sharp and plain. He took the second pressure, and as he released death, as it became too late for him to stay his action, the wolf's noble head turned, and through the scope Nugent found himself staring into human eyes, dark blue eyes like his own, which pleaded with him. Nugent jerked up in his bed, screaming. In her penthouse room, the best in the apartment from which she had a wonderful panoramic view of city and sky, Mariana shifted uneasily in bed. She awoke briefly, confused, thinking that she had heard an animal howling. How could she have done? This was the city. Muttering sleepily, she turned over and drifted off once more. Item display. Wallace Plumtree looked around him with interest. It looks a little different from when I was last here, he said. You've got sharp eyes, acknowledged Nugent. I like change. I get bored easily. I've arranged things now so that the trophy can be displayed to better advantage. I thought here, he indicated an area of highly polished wooden floor, in front of the huge fireplace with its heap of artificial logs. Perfect, Plumtree motioned to his chauffeur to lay down the bulky parcel. When the man had left the room, his employer removed the lid from the box and tenderly lifted out the contents. There, Mr. Nugent, I'm as proud of that as of anything I've ever done. The wolf's head lived. Plumtree had prepared it to seem that the beast was at rest, lazily satisfied with a glint of knowing wisdom in the glass eyes. The pelt shone from the loving attention which had been paid to it, silver highlights glistening in the matte grayness. Going to his knees, a taxidermist arranged the wolfskin, then looked to Nugent for approval. The hunter nodded. Thank you, Mr. Plumtree. I am very pleased, he grinned. Our finest work, I think. In the strange lambency of another dimension, something stirred, a patch of darkness which stretched itself into a long and slender lupine shape, created a vengeance from nothingness. Its sole need was to destroy. With a silent snarl, the ethereal creature set out to find its prey. Item, shame. With only the most perfunctory of knocks, Mariana strode into the trophy room, a swirl of white blonde hair and lithe body and silken robe. Nugent was sitting, whiskey in hand, contemplating the remains of the great wolf with satisfaction. What do you want? Asked the man without looking up. More money, I suppose. I want to go shopping, his mistress told him. It's better than sitting around here on my butt while you spend all your time among these masculine souvenirs of yours. Nugent glared but said nothing. Although a violent man, he prided himself on never having raised a hand to a woman. Mariana pushed him, though. Jesus Christ, did she push him. He pressed buttons on his desk computer, tore off the credit check it printed, and thrust it towards her. The woman took the check without a word of thanks. Instead, she stepped over to the wolfskin and looked down at it with something like contempt. She said, since this goddamn thing came here, you've spent most of your time just gazing at it. What goes through your mind when you're doing that, Nugent? Wondering what it would be like to lay me on it? Fan chance of that. Seeing that you can't get it up anymore. Hell, I might as well be a nun for all the action I'm getting. She wandered to one of the weapons cases and tapped her fingers on the glass lid. Guess that's why you collect all these guns and things, she added, and why you enjoy killing. It's all about penis substitutes and feeling macho, isn't it? Nugent drained his glass and poured himself another Glenlivet. Why do you stay here, Mariana? There's nothing left between us, and you can't stand me anymore. Remember our cohabitation agreement, honey, she mocked. If I go voluntarily, I get nothing. And I've had enough of nothing in my life. You want rid, you send me away. And pay for it. God knows you can afford it. Or are you afraid I'll tell the world that the mighty hunter's impotent? It'd take a lot of killing to rid yourself of that particular shame, wouldn't it, Nugent? Well, must go. Thanks for the check. Hey, maybe I'll buy you a present. How about a set of iris splints for your dick? As Nugent watched the woman leave the room, his fist tightened slowly until the whiskey glass crushed, driving long splints into his fingers and palm. Blood spurted, but Nugent paid no heed. He noticed neither the pain of the cuts nor the sting of the spirit as it seeped into his wounds. Somewhere in another plane, the ebon prowling wolf shape stopped and raised its head, nostrils flaring. It had caught the whiff of something to lead it to its eagerly sought goal, the mingled odors of scorn and shame and hatred and blood. Interlude, Dream Place. Nugent stood on top of the rock, filling his lungs with the clean air of a mountain evening. Scents undreamed of called to him, told him tales of the forest, told him where the prey was, where the pack was, where his beloved mate, the alpha female, romped with her cubs. His greatly altered color perception turned the landscape, the mountains and sky, the very rock on which he stood, into a bizarre and fascinating composition in monochrome. He stretched, Tensing and relaxing his powerful muscles spread his great fang jaws wide in a yawn. Never in his life had he felt so alive, so at one with the environment. Without knowing why, he felt other presences in this place of peace. He turned his great head and saw the three man creatures. Two of them were of the ancient race, and he could feel the emanations of their admiration and awed respect. Then he realized what the third man thing was about. It looked at him over the barrel of a killing stick, staring at him intently with its yellow wolf eyes. Recognition of imminent death came to Nugent much too late, for the death dart struck him even as he was crying out, reaching out to his brother. Mariana jerked from slumber with a muffled cry. Some dreadful noise had awoken her, just like several nights ago. And there it was again, the howling of an animal. A dog, perhaps. But dogs weren't common in this part of the city. In fact, the weird and frightening noise seemed to have come from somewhere inside the building, even inside the apartment. But that was impossible, wasn't it? Mariana slipped from her bed, tiptoed quietly to her door and listened. She wasn't sure, but she had the impression that something was creeping around out there. She even thought that she heard a low snuffling, as if the skulking thing was trying to sniff her out. Despite the room's warmth, she shivered violently and felt her bare body crawl with goose flesh. She pressed her thumb against the security reader, and it locked the door in response. Marianne ran back to the bed and hid her head beneath the top sheet. She slept badly for the remainder of that night. Item, Night Hunt. Two cops stood in a doorway in a mean part of the city, smoking an illicit cigarette each. Their conversation was mainly precinct scuttlebutt, interspersed with derogatory comments about their captain, a dipshit with his nose stuck firmly up the commissioner's ass. One of them leaned out of the doorway to dispose of his cigarette butt and jerked back, cannoning into his partner. "Hell, what was that?"
"What was what?" said the other policeman, stepping out onto the sidewalk.
"I don't see nothing."
The first cop joined him.
"I'm not sure. I thought I saw something dash between those two alleys over there. Just a glimpse out the corner of my eye. I don't know. It could have been a big dog. It could have been a man crouched down."
His partner was just saying, "Okay. So let's take a look." When the night was made hideous by several high, thin shrieks.
"Christ almighty!"
Pulling their machine pistols, both cops rushed towards the source of the terrible noise. Covered by his partner, the first cop dived into the alley, flicked on his flashlight. There was nothing there save the remains of what could have been a cat, mangled and torn. Blood and guts everywhere, as they told the guys back at the station house later. It had got so bad that old Weasel could smell himself, but he didn't give a shit. He'd found them a good solid cardboard box, big enough to sit upright and lie down. Plenty of newspapers for blankets and a fine spot over a warm air vent. A piece of sacking covering the front of the box, and his world was his castle. Okay, so he got a little gamey when warm. So what? Any bastard didn't like it could stand downwind. He itemized the gleanings from tonight's search among the garbage cans. A quarter loaf, a bit stale, but at least it didn't have blue whiskers. Some chicken and burger scraps, a selection of throw-out vegetables, and fruit disposed of by a Chinese restaurant. In fact, a feast. Why, he'd even found a paper bag with some stale donuts. And to wash it all down, a bottle of Weasel's special Skullbuster, a liter jug of cheap Muscatel with a dash of Sterno to give it a lift. Vintage this very evening. "Hey, what's that?" There was somebody nosing around outside, probably after a handout. "Get lost, you bum! Go find your own booze," yelled Weasel, just as the curtain of sacking was wrenched aside. Most people couldn't stand Weasel's stink. The thing that hauled him from his cardboard cave to rent him didn't seem to be all that fussy. Slick Gerber took his latest girl into the park to make out. Slick fancied himself a hard case. The thought of muggers and worse didn't worry him. He was well armed, as well as the essential packet of rubbers. Hell, he didn't know who she'd push out to before, didn't he? He packed a switchblade and an old Ivor Johnson 32, both of which he enjoyed using. He may have been well prepared for muggers, but not for what found him and Rhonda in the bushes. There were others. Mr. Peters was an insomniac,
who liked to walk at night. Lucy Delgado thought her neighborhood was safe to go jogging. Bill Bruckner was sneaking home after an illicit liaison with a woman who was not his wife. When the reports from various precincts were collated the next day, consensus was that some asshole had dumped a number of aging, redundant, and somewhat hungry fighting mastiffs into the community. And that was just the first night. Nugent awoke, his head and limbs and eyeballs aching as if he'd been on the greatest bender of his life. Worse, his abdomen felt dreadfully distended, as if he had been force-fed during the night. He practically fell from his bed and stumbled his way into the bathroom. He pulled the light cord and winced as he caught sight of his image in the floor-to-ceiling mirror. God, what had he been doing? And where the hell had that dirt all over his naked body come from? Well, he had gotten stuck into the scotch the previous evening, but so he had on many other occasions. He'd always remembered what he'd done before. Feeling more sick than ever, Nugent relieved himself and vowed never again. Item bloodlet. It's always the cops who have to pick up the pieces, sometimes, literally. The bizarre and savage killings in the city had continued intermittently for several weeks. The official line was still that a pack of fighting dogs was on the loose, but in the privacy of the precinct bullpen, some detectives were beginning to wonder if there was a real nut somewhere out there. A nut who was just that bit worse than the run-of-mill nut. The tabloid press was beginning to speculate along the same lines. The clincher for this unpublicized line of thought came with the last night of slaughter of the crazies. The rookie cop who found what was left of the street gang upchucked violently, then lapsed into shock. His partner, older and generally more phlegmatic, slumped down on his butt in the gutter amid the mud and grime and garbage and worse. He drank the best part of the flask of good Irish whiskey he carried before calling in. Soon the place was crawling with uniformed men and detectives and paramedics. The reckoning was that there were at least four bodies, although it might take a series of autopsies to be sure. Then back of a local store, somebody found a junior gang member intact, but almost insane with terror. At the time, all they could get out of him was that he was called Zip. He was scrawny and underfed. His nose ran constantly, and all around his mouth was the telltale rash of a solvent abuser. Zip remained under heavy sedation for a couple of days before he could speak to investigating officers. Statement of Charles Zip Bellinger, member of youth gang known as the Crazies. Me and some of the guys was hanging out. There was Jocko, One Eye, Tattoo Nick, and Rammer, as well as me. We was a little high doing some sniffing, figured that a bit of bloodletting would give us a buzz. We wandered the turf, hoping that maybe we'd find some guy from one of those spit gangs, carve him up good. Didn't have no luck. Then Rammer spotted this creep. Looked like some kind of loony. You believe it, he was naked. In this weather, well, maybe not quite naked. He was wearing some kind of coat and cap made out of something furry. Thought we'd have some fun with him. Didn't think there was nothing to worry about. We was all carrying, you know, knives, clubs like that. We go over, get all around him. One Eye says something like, "Hey, man, you're crazy? We crazies, too." Like One Eye, he enjoyed playing with words. Then Rammer, he says, "Only room on this turf for us crazies, man. Don't want no other crazies here. Guess we're going to have to teach you a lesson, man. Punish you real good." Then, you know what happens? Don't mind telling you. Scared the shit out of me, man. This crazy guy looks round at us. Then he smiles real slow, like he's the one about to have fun and not us. Well, Rammer, he gets real pissed with this guy's grin and says, "First swing to me, fellers." Then he goes in with his club. Man, that guy gutted Rammer. He moved so fast, I mean fast. 1 minute Rammer's there with his club, so the nails go right into the guy's skull. Next, the guy's ripped him from cock to throat. Insides falling out, blood everywhere. You know what was worse? I think I saw the bastard pull something out of Rammer and stuff it in his mouth. One Eye goes in with his switch knife. This asshole tears his arm straight from the socket. Starts to use it as a weapon. I saw him rip Jocko's head off too. That was when I chickened out, man. I ran, got to the alley, looked back. My buddies, they was all down. bastard didn't pay me no heed, 'cause he was starting to take them apart, and I don't think they was all dead, 'cause at least one of them was screaming real loud. Jesus, he was using his bare hands and teeth to take them apart. A gigantic mirror graced one wall in the bathroom, and Nugent looked in horror at his reflection. Where in the name of sweet God had all that dried blood come from? Because he certainly didn't have any wounds. Suddenly his gut heaved, and he staggered to the lavatory bowl, just making it before he spewed. He stared aghast at the reddish-brown mess his stomach had rejected. Then he threw up again. His mouth and nostrils filled with the foul taste and odor of stale blood as spasm after spasm tore through him. Nugent's physician examined him thoroughly, took a series of x-rays, asked a number of personal and pertinent questions. At the end of the session, the doctor was not sure that his patient was telling him the truth, that the man had vomited so much blood. Mr. Nugent might have thought that he had done so, but the doctor doubted it. "I can find nothing wrong physically. It's possible some kind of psychosomatic illness. I'd like to refer you to a colleague of mine who understands more thoroughly about these things." Interlude, dream place. Nugent loped at a steady pace through the darkness, instinct carrying him over the lumpy and rock-strewn terrain without stumbling, helping him to avoid colliding with the tall trees which forested his habitat. All around and behind him he could sense his fellow pack members, companions whose loyalty and love were almost tangible in his new awareness. As he ran, he slitted his eyes against the light breeze, blowing into his face the breeze which carried the scent of fleeing prey ahead. Nugent was in no great hurry to catch up with the prey. While the pack was driven by hunger to hunt, there remained a certain thrill in the chase which became anticlimactic when the quarry was eventually brought down. He threw back his head and howled. Howled to communicate with his mate, to communicate with the pack. Howled as an expression of the sheer joy of living. Answering cries came from the pack. Cries which were pitched at differing tones and levels to acknowledge position in the hierarchy. Nugent came to a break in the tree line, saw that the slope shallowed as it swept down to the valley far below. The moon goddess dominated this crystal sky, her frosty light a welcome beacon for the pursuers. Ahead, 400 or 500 meters down the hillside, Nugent could see the victims, two of them both man-creatures. He stopped momentarily and belled his triumph to the mountains. The other pack members too had stopped, their baying cries echoing his. They stood awaiting his command, fierce gray animals with tongues lolling, panting breath steaming the night air. Nugent felt a rush of emotion such as he had never experienced in his life. He cried out again and leapt onwards, the other wolves close at his heels. The man-things, male and female, must have realized that they were beaten, for they turned at bay, naked and helpless against the power of the ancient enemy, terror-riven faces illuminated by the icy and uncaring moon. The man's face was that of Nugent himself, the woman's Mariana. Nugent sprang at his alter ego, massive jaws clashing to tear away jugular and carotid. The rush of hot blood was wine to the beast, rich, intoxicating, life-giving. Nugent stepped back, signaling to the pack that they could feast. As they jumped in to rend the helpless flesh, Nugent turned to stalk the woman. Previously, Nugent would have emerged from these nightmares in a state of gibbering terror, but after some weeks of therapy he was beginning to grasp why his sleeping mind played such dreadful pranks. He could understand the deep guilt of his subconscious. There was something else, something he had not, probably would not, admit to Dr. Cudlip. The dreams were becoming pleasurable, the chase, the kill, the piquancy of fresh, warm blood, all were becoming things to be savored, and Nugent was waking up with other lusts, renewed lusts. Item, bloodlust. Dr. Cudlip could well have afforded a suite of offices in one of the new blocks of town, all glass and chrome, modern art and spindly uncomfortable furniture, but he clung doggedly to a two-room office in the tired precinct where he had started out years before. The building was a gloomy old brownstone, shared with a sleazy gumshoe, two fortune-tellers and a pornographer. It was as if Cudlick was making a statement. "Hey, I'm successful and rich, and so are my patients. I just don't need to prove it." Many employees would have refused to work overtime in such a place. After dark, the streets outside became ill-lit, decaying canyons shunned by the wary. But Nancy Rice lacked both imagination and a sense of caution. Besides, the returns for working late were worthwhile. Only at one point during the evening had Nancy Rice felt any apprehension. She was working in Dr. Cudlip's office, which was dark save for an aura of light spilling onto the desk from his green-shaded banker's lamp. The door between the outer office and reception area, badly illuminated by an ancient lighting system, was ajar. Nancy had jumped when the thin bar of dull yellow extending across Cudlip's floor was suddenly extinguished. Holy shit! Calming herself with several deep breaths, she had gone into the outer office, had worked the switch several times. Either the damn bulb had gone or the old wiring was giving out. Even the stolid Nancy felt something oppressive in the impenetrable darkness. She also had a strange feeling that maybe she was no longer alone. Nancy was glad to get back to the doctor's desk and the friendly lamplight. Scattered on the desk were a large number of buff-colored files marked confidential. Many of them were open, revealing dark, dark secrets. Nancy Rice had been having a great time, and now she picked up the doctor's telephone to share the fun with her friend, Charlene. Nancy Rice's presence in that place was a bad mistake. In fact, that whole day in Dr. Cudlip's office had been a small series of misadventures which became one huge tragic error. Nancy Rice should not have been placed in a position like this, and normally the agency knew it. Unfortunately, the agency was using a stand-in day supervisor that morning. When the psychiatrist had telephoned asking for an emergency receptionist, only Nancy was available. There was nothing wrong with Nancy's work. She was an efficient administrator. But she was a pry and a gossip. Letitia, the doctor's regular nurse, had come into work determined not to let the incipient influenza beat her. For much of the morning, she had worked in a desultory manner before giving in to her sickness. Almost her last action of the day was to answer a telephone call from a fairly new patient, Mr. Smith. Smith had asked for an evening appointment, his usual practice. Letitia had acknowledged the appointment, but had failed to make a note of it. By the time she asked Cudlip to excuse her, she was very ill and forgotten all about Mr. Smith. When Nancy Rice had arrived, the day's paperwork was well behind. Dr. Cudlip had asked Nancy if she would mind staying on to finish up. "I don't mind how late," he had instructed. "I'll clear it with your supervisor and pay for your overtime. Do a good job and I'll throw in a bonus just between you and me." Nancy Rice needed the money, so she had jumped at the chance. The doctor gave her his keys, saying that they should be handed to the janitor when Nancy departed for the night. Dr. Cudlip left happily unaware that he would never have to pay the bonus. Recovering from her mild shock when the outer light had popped, Nancy became so engrossed with the files. Such fun reading about this bunch of loonies. She told Charlene that she failed to notice the passing of time. She continued to read the secrets of human despair and misery to Charlene. After a while, an odd noise distracted her. "Anything wrong, honey?" asked Charlene. "I don't know. I thought I heard something out there." Hold on the line, Charlene," Nancy said, the handset aside, peered into the dark shadows surrounding her, futilely trying to see through the partly open door into the outer office. She called out, "Hello, is anybody there?" The responding silence was stifling. Nancy tried again, more loudly, then shivered. After a moment, she returned to her friend. "Hi. Guess I'm imagining things. Shouldn't have read so many of these files. Now I've saved the best one for last, kid. Get this. The doctor's got a patient who thinks he's a wolf. Calls himself Smith, like, who does he think he's kidding?" She listened with delight to Charlene's shrieking laughter and tumbling words of disbelief. Nancy chuckled. "Yeah, that's right, a wolf." Charlene asked something. "Guess maybe he runs around howling at the moon, things like that," mused Nancy. Charlene said something else, and Nancy tittered. "I suppose he carries a poop scoop." Then, "Hey, I think I heard that noise again. Maybe there is somebody there. Could be the janitor. Better hang up after all. The doctor's paying good rates. Call you later, honey. And hey, Charlene, don't let the wolf man get you." Still sniggering, she hung up. And as she did so, Mr. Smith partly stepped from the shadows. "Jesus, you scared me," cried Nancy. and then she took a good look and realized she might have plenty of reason to be scared. There was something wrong with the man's indistinct shape. Maybe it was the odd fuzziness of his outline, or perhaps the way his shoulders hunched. And then there was the peculiar way his head thrust forward, as if he intended to sniff at her. Nancy's breath caught in her throat. Then she tried to rationalize the situation. Maybe this guy wasn't a threat. Maybe this was some kind of a sick joke. Yeah, that could be it, some kind of initiation prank to test the new girl on the block. But there was something else very wrong, something about the man's eyes. In the dim light, those eyes were shining bright red. Nancy crammed knuckles into her mouth. People's eyes don't reflect light, do they? Then the man smiled at her as he took a step forward, and Nancy began to weep. The smile was knowing, hungry, and marred by a thin line of drool, depending from the bottom lip. The office door was jammed closed so tightly that Dr. Cudlip had to summon the janitor to help him get it open, and when they had forced their way in, both men wished that the day hadn't even started. The first thing they noticed was the charred smell, as if there had been a burning in the suite. In the middle of the floor was a metal waste bin filled with burnt papers and the stiffer remnants of file covers. Then their senses were assailed by the sight and slaughterhouse odor of the blood splashed all around the office, great gouts and pools on walls and floor and ceiling. And finally, in Dr. Cudlip's sanctum, they saw the human shambles which had been Nancy Rice, a once-living being reduced to the slops of a butcher's tray. The very worst thing was the head glued to the desktop by a puddle of congealing blood. The face had been almost totally torn away, but the eyes were intact, and they stared mockingly at the two men. The janitor fainted, and silent tears of anguish poured down Dr. Cudlip's face. Item confession. Father Galvez came through from the sacristy, being careful to secure the door behind him. Not even a church was safe now. The bad ones, they had no respect. He crossed the church, his progress making little noise save for the slight swish of his cassock's hem brushing against the stone flags. He paused in the presbytery to genuflect before the altar and make the sign of the cross. Rising, the priest turned and looked down the nave towards the distant entrance, which was barely visible in the dim illumination cast by the few low-powered light bulbs high in the vaulted ceiling. The air in the old church was thick with the mingled smell of candle wax and polish and incense. Father Galvez took a deep breath, enjoying the heady odors, to him a rich olfactory wine. As was common, the pews were empty, lending a hollowness to the church. Galvez sighed. So few attended in this godless age. Whereas once, in dead years past, the church was never quite empty. Now it rarely saw a worshiper except for a handful of elderly parishioners on Sundays. And yet, despite this paucity, Galvez was of the old school. The younger priests, the moderns, would be out there with the street people, preaching their radical ideas and openly defying the Vatican. But he, Galvez, maintained a punctilious adherence to the old and honored routines. Each evening at 7 he would occupy a stall in the confessional and wait 2 full hours, reading his breviary with difficulty in the feeble glow of a small wall lamp. When penitents did come, he heard the same so-called sins over and over in a variety of voices. Small, meaningless sins, petty tales of spite and jealousy and lust and weakness. How he wearied of them at times. The priest smiled, a small, self-deprecating twitch of the lips. Charity, Galvez, he reminded himself, as he walked to the far transept and took his seat in the confessional. Kissing his stole, he placed it around his shoulders and opened his prayer book. He prepared for a long, probably fruitless wait. He must have dozed momentarily, for he was suddenly jerked awake by the sounds of the other door closing and someone settling on the far side of the screen. Galvez reached up and snapped out the light. The poor illumination from outside the confessional revealed a black shadow pressing near to the screen. "Father? Are you there, Father?" A man's voice, well educated by the sound of it. Odd in this neighborhood, but low and hoarse. "I need help." "Yes, my son, I'm here," Galvez replied. The priest's appearance, stocky, swarthy almond eyes and black hair, heavily grayed at the temples, all proclaimed his Hispanic origins. But his voice, even when lowered and gentle, spoke harshly of the Lower East Side. "What is it you wish to tell me?"
"Father, I've done something so dreadful."
The other's voice trailed off, only to start again with hesitant words, as if the ritual was half forgotten.
"Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been so many years since I last confessed, so many long years, years in which I thought I didn't need you, but now..." Galvez heard a noise like a sob. "Easy, my son," he soothed. "I have all the time that you need." "I have sinned through the years, Father, many sins, some of them utterly vile sins." There was despair in the voice, and Galvez felt a strong surge of pity. "I have no time to go through those sins," the hidden visitor continued. "Damn it, I've forgotten many of them, for my conscience is long dead. I guess that God will know of them, though. But now I carry a burden which I can't shed. I've taken a soul, and I've condemned that soul to restless wandering. And it's haunting me, Father, it's haunting me to the point of insanity." Father Galvez made a small sign, an insignificant gesture of the hand, as if the other could see him.
"You have killed?"
I think so. More than once, I think. But it's the soul. I cannot rid myself of the soul."
"Whose was the soul which haunts you, my son?" the priest asked.
"The Indian warned me. He warned me."
"Whose soul, Father?"
"Why, the wolf.
The great, wonderful timber wolf which I destroyed in my lust for trophy."
"What is this you're saying?" demanded Galvez. His voice was suddenly cold, compassion gone. "You are telling me that you are haunted by the soul of a wolf? Are you mocking me, man?"
"No!" Galvez recognized the genuine anguish in the shouted protest. "I'm not mocking you. I need your help to rid me of this thing."
"But animals do not have souls, my son."
"They do, Father. God knows that they do."
The priest's voice became icy once more. "If you are Catholic, you will know Holy Mother Church's stance on this, that animals do not have souls. If you persist with this delusion, then I cannot help you."
"You must help me."
The other voice now held the pleading note, almost a whine. "I tell you, Father, that the wolf has a soul, and the soul cries for vengeance."
Galvez frowned. "Have you considered seeking psychiatric help, my son?"
"I've tried that."
"Damn you, priest. It didn't work. And anyway, I'm not mad. I may have said this thing is driving me to madness, but I'm not mad."
"I dare say you are mad. Disturbed, perhaps. Whatever is wrong with you, it seems to me to be a problem more for a doctor than a priest. If you have genuine sins to confess, I will hear you and give absolution, if you are truly penitent. Other than that, I can do nothing for you."
A stertorous breathing came from behind the screen, and below it another noise like the grinding of teeth, and an unsure Father Galvez thought that he heard a low growling sound.
"Go to a psychiatrist, my son," he urged. "My advice is offered in your best interests. I will pray for you, and God will help you."
"You fool! You holy fool!" growled the other. There was a crashing noise as he kicked his way out of the confessional, and then the priest's door was wrenched open. Father Galvez started up, then gasped with shock as he saw what confronted him. The priest's last thought, ironic in its certainty, was that God would not, could not help him. An old woman came down the sidewalk towards All Souls, tottering slightly on chunky varicose legs. Mrs. Jablonski was ashamed, for that very afternoon she had reviled a neighbor, a poor silly woman of low intelligence who had meant no harm. Mrs. Jablonski had a soft heart and knew it would do her good to make reparations before our Lord. It would be so comforting to see the good Father Galvez. Item mating. The central heating in the apartment was kept high during the fall and winter, so high that Mariana habitually slept naked. For some weeks now she had fallen out of the practice of locking her door at night, ever since noticing that Nugent was no longer behaving oddly, was no longer having the terrible dreams which made him cry out so hideously in the night. Mariana's unclad form was sprawled face down on the counterpane on the midnight that Nugent came to her after such a long period of neglect.
She was awakened by the weight of his body crushing down on top of her.
Nugent, what the hell?
Quiet, he hissed. Don't say anything.
Mariana became aware of the heat of a swelling penis thrusting against her.
Hey, Nugent, she purred.
What's come over you? She tried to turn around to welcome him with her arms.
Don't move!
There was an odd growling timbre to his voice, coupled with a note of urgency.
Stay as you are and keep quiet.
Mariana acquiesced, content to lie prone and let Nugent make all the play. She realized that, unlike herself, the man was not fully naked. He was wearing some kind of robe, for she felt coarse fur caressing her skin as he moved about her. She began to purr and melt at his fingers and tongue, probe roughly at her private places, making her deeply moist. Then Nugent lifted the woman's hips and took her savagely from behind, not making love but rutting. There was slight pain, but it was enjoyable, and Mariana submitted to it. She felt only ecstasy and relief as the man's hardness pounded into her body. She yelled and sobbed aloud as Nugent brought her to orgasm once, twice, yet again. When the man climaxed, his cry was animal in its intensity. He collapsed upon her, holding her to the bed. Gradually, she relapsed to sleep. Nugent opened his eyes slowly, aroused by the light which was shining in then. A full moon showed through the upper windows of the room, shedding illumination into the disheveled bed and onto Nugent's face. His eyes glinted redly, and he felt a primitive urge to lift his head and bay at the silver orb. As he awakened more, he became aware of Mariana's soft body lying beneath his. The pungent smell of woman musk arose from her, and Nugent could feel himself becoming roused once more. But it was more than a sexual desire. There were other lusts, other passions, which overwhelmed him and took precedence over the urge to mate. Finale, Soul of the Wolf. Nugent came to exhausted and stiff. He was curled up on the floor of his trophy room, almost naked. The room was not quite dark. Subdued early dawn filtered through the fine drapes, providing some vision. The man raised his head with difficulty, feeling as much as seeing the artificial, disapproving glares of the beast which he had killed. There was some kind of covering over him. He took a loose end in trembling fingers and stared at it. It was the skin of the timber wolf, the head resting atop his own, forelegs draped and tied about his neck, the body fitting snugly to his back as if it belonged, the hind legs and tail falling down behind him. Nugent struggled to hands and knees, rested there, shaking his head, trying to get his thoughts into order. He recalled going to bed, overcome with a strange lethargy which was all too common now, maybe something to do with his medication. But no, he'd stopped taking that when he stopped going to Dr. Cudlip. Why had he stopped going? He couldn't even remember that. So much eluded him now, so much. Then there was something else, something to do with Mariana. What? He remembered. He had gone to Mariana in the night, and he had made love to her, had taken her with all the force and vigor which had once been his. But if he had slept with Mariana, then why did he end up here on the floor? Still in a dazed state, Nugent crawled over to his desk and, grasping the edge with both hands, hauled himself to his feet. There was a slight and unpleasant stickiness either on his hands or on the edge of the desk. Shuffling toward the door, Nugent found the switch and snapped the ceiling lights on. His hands and fingers were dyed with a partly dried reddish mess, which was also thick beneath his nails. Other stains blotched his torso and legs, while a glimpse in a polished silver wall plate showed his face to be similarly smeared. Darkening patches disfigured the floor at his feet. Trembling, Nugent opened the door and looked out into the hall. Mingled trails of drying drops and splashes meandered throughout the apartment. With a feeling of sick horror in his heart, Nugent dashed up the stairway and flung open the door to Mariana's room, his hand leaping instinctively to flick on the light. He was unable to prevent himself from screaming when he saw the carnage. Mariana, beautiful, vibrant, cold-hearted Mariana, was transformed into a shredded symphony in scarlet, an abstract canvas composed from gore and flesh and entrails. Nugent threw back his head to scream a second time. Instead, the steadily rising croon of a wolf burst from his lips, filling the apartment with cold and lonely lamentation.
Nugent unlocked a weapons display case and selected the open razor, testing its keenness with the ball of his thumb. A bright pearl of blood oozed up. "That'll do," he muttered. He hurried into the bathroom and stood before the massive mirror. Regarding his reflection with sick loathing, he placed the edge of the razor beneath his left ear. After a tentative jab or two, he pressed the blade home firmly and drew it swiftly to the right.